Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment, and sometimes darker things. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, a lot of BS, FW. We'll explain that in a while. And before that, a review of the movie Arrival by Daniel Persons. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I kicked myself in last week's review for indulging in cliché, and I'm going to do it again, but it's the best way, I think, to start off this review. You know that saying, if you have a hammer, every problem is a nail? I have a concern that when I'm reviewing a film, I'm automatically invoking a corollary. If you think 2001 Space Odyssey is the greatest SF film ever made, then every great SF film is 2001. I don't think I'm as bad as all that, but I do note that when I'm taken with a film, I will look for elements of Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece in it. And when I do that, I do have to wonder whether I'm taking a round hole and trying to force a monolith-shaped peg into it. In the new and very good SF film Arrival, based on Ted Chiang's Nebula Award-winning novella Story of Your Life, Amy Adams plays Louise, a talented linguist who's drafted, willingly and eagerly, into a military-run operation that's trying to figure out a way of communicating with aliens who have parked their ovoid-shaped ships at seemingly random places around the world. We, of course, are way out of the summer film season, so no whizzing attack drones here. Bill Pullman doesn't show up for any kind of strident speechifying, although Jeremy Renner is around as a very appealing male counterpart for Louise, and Forrest Whitaker brings both authority and humanity in his role as the colonel in charge of the operation. What we do get is something deeper and, frankly, more awe-inspiring, and also more complex as competing science teams the world over try different means to communicate with the visitors, who mostly convey their thoughts by scribing inky, circular glyphs in the air. I'll be a little heretical here and say that the film's outlook is a better rendition of what The Martian was shooting for, a serious regard of the realities of science and scientists without the forced next-gen, let's-everybody-get-along attitude. In fact, international tensions and human self-interest are very much key to the message director Denis Villeneuve is trying to convey, primarily how our struggles look from a more cosmic scale. And here's where we get into the 2001 aspect. It does seem that director Villeneuve is using 2001 as a clear touchstone. While the black, egg-like alien ships, they're actually called shells in the film, are not quite as elemental a form as a monolith, they get close enough. There are games with artificial gravity and perspective similar to what Kubrick did, and a glass-covered aperture in the ship's interior anteroom that allows the humans to meet face to kind of face with the aliens takes a shape reminiscent to the space station docking bay in 2001. More, Arrival is not afraid to leaven its science with mysticism, particularly how the death of Louise's daughter molds her interactions with the aliens. And I have to be careful here, because actually that aspect, which on the surface appears to be just some emotional grounding for the character, and very effective grounding at that, leads to revelations that go far deeper and more profoundly, and surprisingly connects this film's view of the universe with Kubrick's use of time to establish humanity's relationship to the cosmos. Villeneuve does this without any trippy light shows, but the effect is still pretty mind-blowing and deeply affecting. Fall may be my favorite time of the year because this is the time when we get the real science fiction films, devoid of marketing concessions and ambitions towards franchises, films that deal with ideas and, ideally, their human impact. Arrival is very much a wonderful example of that, and it couldn't arrive at a better time. And I feel I have to say something about last week's events, and I will be quick about it because this is really not the place for it, and next week I'll be back to my stock tag to prove that. One of the things the other side is counting on is for us to despair, for us to be afraid, and there are those among us who will have every right and reason to be afraid. But the thing that will tick the Trumpists off most is if, as much as we can, we laugh and we share and we celebrate that we are black and white and Christian and Muslim and Jew and atheist, that we are diverse and maybe a little crazy. This is not an end in itself. We cannot just sit back and think a smile is going to defeat the manure show that is very likely to come. But for now, rejoice that none of us are alone. They have a lot of power, but we are not powerless, and we are going to show it. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
And for Dan Persons, I'm Hour of the Wolf. Well, okay. I would like to be able to come on the air and have played something that occurred in this very building, but on the first floor last night, where we had Kitch Johnson, who was fabulous, and Sonia Taaffe, who was fabulous, reading from their fiction. It was, if I say so myself, a good pairing. And many of the readings that I hold, the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, I get guest curators. One person in the room now is going to be doing January, in fact, and three of the four people in the room right now, not counting myself, are going to be doing engineering for it, as Terrence Taylor decides that he has a life. I don't know what gave him the right to think that, but all right. So we're creating, we still haven't named what it's going to be. Terrence Taylor's terrific text.
I like that better than Terrence's Minions.
Yeah, get near a microphone.
I like that one better than Terrence's Minions. I think that
Minions along the lines. Terrence would like to have Minions.
Minions is right out. It is not alliterative.
No, it has to be four T's.
It's also trademarked too, right? We can't actually use that.
No, we can. I mean, before on Buffy, what was the name of the woman who became the girl who became the vampire and then turned over into Angel as well? Melanie?
I know who you mean, but my sister would know.
But the line that they used, oh, Harmony. Her name was Harmony, and yeah. she was sort of like an airhead, and she eventually becomes a vampire with those who are doing her bidding.
Spoilers, man.
No, but
for a 20-year-old show, yeah.
I haven't gotten to Angel yet.
Well, no, this is Buffy. This is like season 3 or 4.
I stopped at season 2.
But what I love about that episode is that the main cast couldn't stop cracking up that she had minions.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They just kept saying Harmony's got minions.
So we can YouTube that, right?
And also, by the way, long before that, Jews had minions. Thank you. We're here until 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And we are. Who am we anyway?
So we are the Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers. I am Mallory Hagman.
I am Terry Clark.
I am Sam Schreiber.
And I am Cameron Roberson, pen name Rob Cameron.
Oh, we're doing pen names?
Or Cam Rob.
Yeah, it's only because I confuse people, so I want to clarify that.
I mean, for the longest time, I thought this guy's name was Cam, okay? Yeah. And I've decided that when he is...
It actually is.
When he is one of the quadruple T minions that are yet to come, once we come up that name, when he's... not when he's hosting or producing it, but when he is operating the technology, the cameras, then your name is Cam on those nights. I've got news for you.
That works for me. I'm my own tautology. That works.
Okay. Well, I also have to announce my pen name. Excuse me.
Oh, yeah.
Please.
Thank you. This is Terry Clark, and my pen name is Zin E. Rocklin. Zin E. Rocklin.
Would you spell that, please?
Zen is Z as in zebra, I as in ice cream, N as in Nancy, the letter E, dot, and then we have Rocklin, which is R-O-C-K-L-Y-N. Thank you.
Very cool. Okay. Overall, these are four of many members of the Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers Group. They are not here because they are that, but because I started last Tuesday freaking out on Facebook and discovered that these same people were having similar freakouts. I can't imagine why you'd think it would be a national problem. or something like that.
Well, because winter's coming, right? I mean, that's the reason.
Winter. You see how I am not. I am not a fire and ice fan.
Ooh. No, just it's winter. Yeah. It's
I'm a big fan. I'm not a Westeros fan. I am a big fan of George R. R. Martin's science fiction.
Oh,
okay.
And some of his fantasy and spec fic, but I am a wuss. Therefore, I don't like the on-screen gore. I don't mind violence. That's one thing. And even the occasional beheading, like in Shakespeare or something like that, which is exactly where he takes it from. Most of the stuff that he puts in there, he gets out of the War of the Roses.
Oh, well, I'm being very literal. I'm Caribbean, so me being here in New York City, when winter is coming, it's
very much coming.
It's traumatic.
Yeah, well, yeah. Lister, who's coming on Afros from Haiti, so you two
we can have
fight
a conversation.
Oh.
Yeah.
And me, too, because, you know, I'm Trinidadian, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there you go. It's here.
Very
winter
cool.
Is here.
Very, yeah, really, really, it is. We'll call Nalo. Never mind.
Oh, I love Nalo. Shout out to Nalo. You're amazing. I love you.
Don't listen to what they're saying.
Excuse me, sir.
We formally apologize to Miss Hopkinson and her...
I don't know what you're talking about. I love you, Nalo.
Her name is Nalo. Anyway, she merely one of the greatest people to walk the face of the planet. But aside from that...
Yeah, no big deal.
No big deal. I met Nalo, one of my second ReaderCon ever. She was out on the lawn with this guy who had this huge video camera. Now her a partner or husband, I'm not sure which, but they're still together. And she was glowing. Brown Girl in the Ring had just been published, her first novel.
And Blurred by Octavia Butler. No big deal.
Yeah.
Just go ahead, drop some names.
I'm just dropping them.
You drop them, I'll pick them up. Octavia was on this show five times, I'll have you.
Stop it, oh my God.
You didn't know that?
I mean, I saw the paper with all the names.
Yeah.
And I saw Octavia Butler.
What chair was she sitting in?
Was the chair here?
Not at this location.
Oh.
She was on mostly at the church, which was 62nd Street and 1st Avenue.
But was this mic used, though? Can you just tell me that the mic was used?
Oh, yes, it was that mic.
Oh, sweet.
The one that
awesome.
You're talking
so
to right now.
This is going to be missing.
Yeah. And actually, the last... The penultimate interview I did was at my house, where we just set up a mic and talked there. Betsy Mitchell brought her over to my place.
Oh, no, what? Sorry. I need a minute. What? She was just in your house.
Yeah.
She's just chilling in your house.
Is
it the same house that you have now?
Yeah.
You want to go to his house
so
now.
Road trip.
You'll be there on a specific day in December. I'll be telling you all, not on the air, when.
Okay. Is the couch still there that she was on?
Actually, yes.
Shut your mouth. I need a new couch, by the way.
We have washed it since it was a few
years
ago.
Whoa, come on!
Okay.
I'm not sure. But I think I did the last actual interview with her.
Aww.
It was horrifying because she was staying at the Washington Square Hotel. Fledgling had just come out. She was in town to get the Lorraine Hansberry Award. Somebody likes that. Some fly-by-night writer. She's getting one of the most prestigious awards that any writer could get, especially a black writer, you know, from the name of a black writer. And she was staying at the Washington Square Hotel. It's almost like a bed and breakfast, really charming place. And we recorded about 40 minutes, all of which is available on my new CD, by the way, my only CD. So it's my new CD called Chatting Science Fiction. And she said that she was a little bit tired and feeling a little bit off. And I said, fine, you're coming back to New York in 3 weeks in order to do some other award, but she was going to go home first. And we got up. Now Octavia was a good-sized, large-boned person.
Yeah.
Consider I'm 5'5". She's like 5'8". And she got dizzy. There were these steep steps. And so she put her full weight on my shoulder, which was considerable. She had a moment of vertigo. She got dizzy because of those stairs.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, but you owe me another show. And she said, fine. that's okay. And she went home, and about a week later, she'd had cement poured for her house. There was a ramp for her mother, and this is all paid for by her MacArthur grant. And she had steps put in. She had told me all about it. It's on that recording. And the steps, the cement was drying, and she was carrying groceries up those steps, and she got an attack of vertigo like she had when she was with me. And she slipped and hit her head on, I said I'm a wuss. She hit her head in the corner of the hardened cement, and that's how she died. And when I found out, I called a former occasional co-host of mine and a former curator at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, Cherie Thomas, who did one of the world-changing books in science fiction called Dark Matter in the year 2000. And I called Cherie and said, okay, so you're going to be doing my show next week, right? And she said, why? I mean, why not, but why?
Yeah.
I said, for Octavia Butler. She said, she's in town?
Oh.
And so I told Cherie what had happened, and Cherie just said very quietly, I have to hang up now. And she did do the show, but that was a moment, that haunting moment where I had to tell somebody that this, you know, larger-than-life hero who was so important to so many of us. But she, and you want to hear the worst part of it? In the interview that I did with her, right after the interview, I said, so Fledgling came out. She had had writer's block for 10 years.
Yeah.
Octavia had had writer's block. I didn't know her well enough to call her Junie, which is what her closest family was. Yeah. So I didn't find that out until later. But I knew her as Octavia. And she said, so you had writer's block all this time. And apparently she credited Harlan Ellison for helping her get out of it. And I said... So are you going to be working on more stuff now? And she said to me, I've got so much good stuff. I've got these ideas for a whole new series. Oh. Yeah, right. So, you know, as if somebody could find those index cards. That's not why we're here this morning.
I know, I'm sorry.
Jim,
I'm sorry.
Jim, shut up, Jim.
Oh.
Ow! Stop slapping.
How about Mallory?
Rob! Terry! Ouch!
Mallory.
What are you doing to me?
I'm just blaming
Sam!
Mallory. We're blaming Mallory all the way.
Okay, you're all beating me up, and rightfully so. Mm-hmm. So, last Tuesday, there was a sea change. And I am going to hold the court for just a little bit longer. Science fiction, I've always maintained, particularly science fiction, less so about fantasy. Westeros, George Martin's writing, is really about, you know, the 16th century and 15th century, and it reflects that. And he throws a little contemporaneous stuff in there as well, for just to shock people. But for the most part, science fiction is about the present. Very much so. The Dispossessed by Le Guin is very much about 1972. Dahlgren, which will be a timeless book, which is a timeless book that will be studied in 100 years, very much captures, you know, this black gay man in 1973 in Greece. Very much captures that if you read between the lines. It's also about the New York that he knew and lived in. Very much so. You can see the streets, especially if you were alive at the time. Orwell was writing about 1948 when he inverted the numbers and made it 1984. And he said this. This is not an interpretation. This is explicit. Cyberpunk is about the 80s. It is about the Reagan era, and you can see what happens there. The science fiction, most of which is on screen, whether the screen be small or large, including not science fiction, but the Marvel universe, and particularly the DC universe, it's like, Superman, you're an alien! Well, they're the good guys, but they're the aliens. They're the migrants. They're the refugees. The Inhumans in Marvel, the X-Men, by Chris Claremont, who very specifically made clear in the comics that Chris wrote about the whole Holocaust connection going back. And I mentioned it last week, I'll repeat this week, I am the product of two Holocaust survivors, my father from Nuremberg, my mother from Frankfurt am Main and living in Prague, who both barely survived the Holocaust. Their families did not. And I was protected from that as a child, but I've learned a lot about it since. And I have perceived of Weimar, New York, for about the last 6 months, as opposed to Weimar, Germany. And now it has come to pass. The person who was able, Germany was a great nation once upon a time, filled with the arts and justice and towering over Europe as a wonderful place with Bach and Beethoven and even Wagner, if you can separate the art from the person, right? And a lot of what was going on up until the, I guess, latter part of the 19th century with all the wars they started getting into with Hindenburg and then what led to World War I with all the idiot children of Veronica. Veronica? Jesus. Back to Buffy. Victoria.
Jim's being rude. He's on his phone.
Yes, I'm on my phone because somebody just messaged me. And I very often check for Facebook messages and Twitter messages during the show. But it was a BAI person who's in the building right now, Lister. So totally unnecessary. And also, my phone was not silenced. I broke my phone last night. And usually I have my phone very well behaved for when I'm on the air. So anyway, lost my total train of thought, but it's irrelevant because we have a lot of interesting people here. My point is that there is a direct parallel, I think, to the to the greatness of Germany and the promises of Chancellor Hitler, saying, and I quote, "We will make Germany great again."
That sounds so familiar. Why is it?
Yeah,
so...
I can't. Well, you were alive then, right?
Yeah, I mean, black doesn't crack.
Yeah.
We just get polished.
And so the thing is that science fiction has really seen this before, haven't we?
Yes.
It is, it's fun to have adventure novels looking between the corruption of governments as written by people like Graham Greene and John le Carré, which, while not science fiction, is genre.
Yes.
But science fiction specifically, from Heinlein, looking, who was not exactly a lefty, who was looking at the demagoguery of any number of characters, including one of his associates by the name of Hubbard. Talk about demagogues. And
literal.
Yeah. And Octavia Butler had a short story about a demagogue president that people said, Octavia predicted this. No. But she knew the kind of world that we were creating for ourselves and that we have now created for ourselves. And I had a very sane, simple reaction to this, which is I put my fingers in my ears. I'm going, blah, 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 blah. I just don't want to deal. I don't want to cope. We shouldn't have to, but it is horrifying.
Absolutely.
And so it seemed like the people that I was in touch with on Facebook, which are some of the people in this room, I thought, okay. At first, I think it was Mallory who first was throwing around stuff, or Rob said, oh, you need to hear what Mallory is saying, that we have to somehow coordinate and do stuff. And I said, well, I'd love to do a town hall downstairs at 388 Atlantic Avenue, where we have this wonderful space that we can do live stream from and things like that. But then was going here and there, and what can we do and who can we include? And I just threw a ball into left field and say, okay, Wednesday night, who's with me? And here they are.
Here we are.
Mm-hmm. All right, so somebody please now talk besides me.
Okay, so I think it might be interesting to go over what we were doing when we found out Trump was our next president and what our first reaction was. Starting with Cam, because he's making direct eye contact with me.
As everybody in the listening audience can see.
Yeah, I'm riveted. This is an important conversation. So I'm sure, like Jim, we kind of watch everything like towers falling down. And I'm a classroom teacher at a public school. And I have, in a public school that services about 90% immigrants in Brooklyn, I have some people who voted for Trump. And they were very clear about the reasons why, and I think we'll get more into that, into the kind of mental dissonance that was required to do that, doing what we do. But I couldn't look them in the eyes and smile the next day. So I basically spent a day in bed with my comics and Seamless, and did my best to try and kind of work my way around it in other ways. So basically doing Brooklyn speculative fiction writer stuff. And we had traveled to Mallory and other people. We had just finished having a meeting about just organizers in general for Brooklyn speculative fiction. We've had kind of a banner year trying to figure out who are we going to be talking to next year for extra meetups, LunaCon, ReaderCon, everything else.
Helioscope, Kaleidocast.
Kaleidocast, our podcast, trying to get all this done.
You're
with
popping
14.
Your piece. Move a little bit Thank back you. From the mic.
And then, and one of Mallory's projects was to get up a new reading series at the Way Station, and to have a email list. And she said to me, "Well, you go ahead and you say what you said, Mallory."
Like in the email I sent you, like right after the election.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's 2 points. Originally, the reading series was supposed to be just like a general reading series, ideally like emerging authors. But the instant that the Trump election happened, I could no longer it felt like anything that I did from this point forward had to be towards something. And so I was like, okay, it has to be people of color. It has to be minorities. It has to be people who are underrepresented in media. Especially emerging writers who don't have those opportunities. And I don't know if I'm the right person to run that because I am white and I can't come from like a really privileged background. But I want to get started.
Yeah. And this all kind of dovetailed to what I was talking to Jim about, because we are already going to have Shan Chakraborty and Fenderson Jelly Clark come in on January 10th for the New York Review of Science Fiction, do a reading, because their works are doing things that take the other and kind of bring it into our kind of our fantastic mainstream. So Shan Chakraborty's new novel is an epic fantasy.
Don't pound the table.
Don't talk into the microphone. Don't talk with your mouth.
Is an epic fantasy that is set in the Middle East. And she's written it in a way where it is, you fall into it and you are immediately immersed in this world.
I haven't read it yet, and people keep talking about it like when I'm around, and I want to read it so badly.
Yeah. And there's another person who I almost had on earlier this year, both on the show and in there, but who wrote a book called Technologies of the Self. Harris Durrani, who Rob has also been batting around the idea, not and was trying to sell it to me, and it's like, no. I know Harris. You don't have to. This is not a hard sell. I'm simply embarrassed that he hasn't read for me or been on the show yet. It must happen. But we're thinking along parallel lines, obviously.
Right. And so there's no reason why not to start this conversation together. You have the venue. You have the voice, and now
I have radio station.
And you have the radio station. So,
which is made for just this kind of thing. Coincidentally, you guys all met with a program director tonight. Program manager. Totally coincidentally, because where we were meeting to warm up for this show, he was already there. So
yeah, and the whiskey was involved.
Mm-hmm. And bourbon.
Bourbon.
Yeah.
Let's be clear there.
Yeah. I like whiskey too, but bourbon is, yeah. Malt scotch is better, but it's pricey. Sam agrees.
On both counts, yes.
Yeah. The point is that this is a terrible, terrible thing to say, but there's a truth to it. This radio station, specifically WBAI, the Pacifica Foundation came out of post-World War II from a bunch of pacifists, specifically a guy named Lou Hill. It's called Pacifica not because of pacifist, but because he lived in Pacifica, California, which is a neighborhood in Berkeley, California, which, by the way, in science fiction land, let's see if anybody in this room knows what organization, what fictional organization is based in Pacifica, California. Da, 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 da. Terry looks like she is on the edge of getting it.
Can I get a Google?
I'll tell you. Starfleet, man!
Oh, right. Yeah.
I kind of expected for Sam to definitely know.
So when you listen to us, remember, we're from Starfleet. But anyway, so Pacifica came out of that kind of thinking. KPFA and their second station, KPFK, that's Berkeley and L.A., flourished. And then this eccentric millionaire, Louis Schweitzer, who owned World Broadcast Associates Incorporated, WBAI, which had been broadcasting since the 40s, he just donated the station to the Pacifica Foundation. Nice donation, which is why we're a non-commercial station at 50,000 watts in the middle of the FM dial. 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York. Okay, it's 6 minutes late, but I got it in anyway. So the... And then along comes, Indochina and the Vietnam War becomes big. Our news director, Paul Fisher, and later on our weekend news director, Margot Adler, start up. Paul Fisher leaves BAI eventually. He goes West Coast. He becomes the only journalist to deal with Patty Hearst in those days. Look her up. And... kids, you're all kids. And
we know who Patty Hearst is. She starred in Network.
That's it. Well, actually, she did, didn't she?
She did. In a manner of speaking.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And Margot, of course.
Mallory's. Patty Shayefsky humor. It's what the kids are after these days.
You can tell I'm the youngest one here.
William Randolph Hearst's daughter.
I spend a lot of time nodding and smiling. It's okay.
Move on. You can look her up. But at any rate, and I'm saying that to the audience as well, it's beside the point at the moment. The weekend news director here was Margot Adler, who then left news director to start some radio show called Hour of the Wolf. And then she went to be one of the founding reporters at National Public Radio and All Things Considered. Underachiever, boring, boring, boring. Anyway, so... the point is that during the Vietnam War, during Watergate, during these eras, where I was very lucky to have, a little corner in which to sit and witness all that went on. I'm not a doer, but I'm an observer. BAI and Pacifica Radio and places not only of the left, because, I used to engineer a fellow named William F. Buckley, who did a radio show here at BAI. He and Abby Hoffman, coming in and going out. We had a show from the KKK, followed by a show from the Black Panthers. There was a time when this station was far more diverse. This would never fly today, believe you me. But the 60s were a very radicalized period where,
So were the shows back to back?
They were back to back.
Okay, so
they were recorded, so the people didn't.
Oh, because I was wondering if they crossed within the hallway.
Well, Abby and Buckley got along. Yes, they did, and more than crossing the hallways, they loved each other. These were two intellectuals. You have to give Buckley. I mean, he was wrong, but he respected. He listened, and he argued with people like Gore Vidal and Abby Hoffman on an intellectual basis. Abby loved, I was business partners with Abby Hoffman. Abby loved Buckley. Buckley loved the discourse that Hoffman could bring if Abby was sober. And there was an hour a week or so. And the, so yes, but no, shows like the KKK show, Let Freedom Ring, it was called.
Okay.
It's that kind of rhetoric.
Sure.
You know, like make America great again. Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of rhetoric. You know, wrap yourselves in the flag. And they did that
like
thing. But actually, a number of the Panthers were here. Julius Lester, who was an important member of the Black Panthers. I was on 5 to 7. He was on 7 to 9.
The fist when you passed by?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, he was like, "It's my turn now." And yes, sir. And I've got lots of Julius stories. He is the wisest person on Facebook. You know what happened to him? He became a rabbi.
I'm sure there's a story there.
There is, but look him up on Facebook or look him up in Wikipedia or something. He is wonderful. He really is. He's amazing. He was very bizarre, and he remains very bizarre. But he is a man of wisdom, but both as a Panther and as a Rib. So the point is that during Victor Rousseau, to quote Victor Rousseau, and I'm quoting now Harlan Ellison quoting Victor Rousseau, during times of strife, and I will add in parens, governmental oppression, the arts will flourish. So what the out of the not yet ashes, but the mental ashes, perhaps, of a Trump-like government, I am hoping for a renaissance of free-thinking thought. And the first place that I look to are the young SF community to help us with that.
I think that's us.
Oh, right.
I think it is.
Shoot.
Yeah.
It's a lot of pressure, actually.
No pressure.
No.
Well, I mean, I agree that certainly in times of strife, just to rehash the entire quote, certainly in times of strife, the you know, art is here to save us. And it's funny, because I saw Zadie Smith tonight at St. Joseph's College, who was interviewed by Ashley C. Ford. And that was one of the things that Zadie touched upon was the renaissance, the new renaissance that is upon us in a way. I'm the one that tends to rain on the parade. I'm sorry, y'all. I love you guys, and I'm really hopeful. I promise you, I am.
But it's gonna rain on the parade.
It's so totally hard to be hopeful.
It's hard to be hopeful. It's very hard to be. It's hard for me to be hopeful in a lot of ways, because to be very honest with you, we have a lot more steps to take within publishing before this renaissance can be actually realized to its fullest potential. After we all know about the Fireside Report. We know about those dismal numbers.
There are a lot of aspects of the Fireside Report. This is another show we should do that I would argue.
Let's do that as well.
But it's better than what they said.
And then
it's still dire.
It's still dire, right.
It's still dire. We'll agree with that.
But then there's also the Publisher Weekly.
And also, by the way, listeners don't know what the Fireside Report is.
Oh, so the Fireside Report was...
And you're popping your piece.
Oh, sorry. Was a metric that was sent out basically reviewing the science fiction and, speculative fiction stories that were released under popular literary magazines, including Fireside itself, such as Strange Horizons, Apex, you know, pretty much the entire spectrum.
No, but see, that's where I disagree. It totally ignored Lightspeed, where I work.
Okay.
Where we put out People of Color Destroy Science Fiction.
Right, yes.
And last year, Queers Destroy Science Fiction. The year before, Women Destroy Science Fiction.
With the specialized issues, yes.
That's right. And I was the podcast host and audio producer, so I'm intimately familiar with all that. And with our editors, Nalo Hopkinson, Nisi Shawl, and Terrence Taylor,
I agree.
And Clark's World has been doing as good a job.
I think to Terry's point, though, is
but yes, that doesn't change. I was just criticizing the report as being not all inclusive.
Even before November 8th, there were a lot of strides that needed to be taken, and it's hard not to think that what just happened on a national scale won't, at the very best, put a lot of that progress kind of on the back burner at best, or on ice.
Right, because not... Yeah. No, hold on, just 1 second. Because it's not just the Fireside Report. It's also the Publisher Weekly's report, in which the overwhelming numbers within publishing is extremely white. It's extremely white. It's extremely cis. And the thing is
define cis for our listeners.
Cis.
CIS.
CIS is the... to put it plainly, the gender that in which you were born into,
right,
or assigned,
or assigned at birth.
Yeah.
So the with that being a problem, and it is a problem, because when there are publications in which they are, you know, they're sent out, and the authors and the content is directly aimed at a specific audience, that alienates one submissions, and it also alienates a certain audience, as well as when on the other side of it, on the publishing side of it as well, when you as a marginalized folk are turning in your story, and someone that is coming from a very middle ground is reading it, they're not going to necessarily understand where the story is coming from, which would then hurt the chances of that story being as pure to what the message is. Either it's going to be edited to hell, or it's going to be just completely ignored.
Or hidden,
yes. Or buried.
Yeah.
You're right.
I mean, like, the anthology you were talking about before, the Queers Destroy Sci-Fi, the People of Color Destroy Sci-Fi, those are reactionary.
Exactly.
And their reaction was actually a reaction to the puppies. Who were getting involved?
Actually, wasn't the puppies specifically? Which idiot blogger was it who said women are destroying science fiction?
Vox.
It was Vox.
It was Vox.
Theodore Beale.
Yes.
Not. Mm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
okay, the puppies.
Yeah. So,
the rabid puppies, not the sad.
Yeah. There's a difference, and I've never actually fully dealt with that on the air because it's just too rabid, if you will. Yeah. But suffice it to say that there is a very small core of thoroughly, in the bad sense, reactionary, rabid people who have took another trope of creating a slate of recommended science fiction, saying, I've got my own publishing company in which I'm only publishing the word of Jesus, the word of science, and this. And because the Hugo Awards are inbred, in which anybody can pay for
a Worldcon membership.
Yeah, it can be gamed. It had been gamed once before, about 20 years ago. People don't remember that. But it had happened. It failed because all the checks that came in were sequential.
Stupid.
But all that's...
You'd think Scientology would know better.
Yeah. but all that is somewhat telling. You know, it's not. If you look back, not even 5 years, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year ago, what happened with Trump really is just kind of it is part of the pushback. And if you look at United States, If you look at, if you take American culture as a whole, you treat it as a human being. That human being really is essentially a 70-year-old bruised ego. White male, And so, right.
I'm only 63.
That's why I didn't include you.
Oh, okay.
70.
Yeah.
I've got 7 yeah. years to go before I turn into that.
Yeah, so this is, in a sense, therapy. And at this point, the therapy is kind of getting to a breaking point where that pushback needs to come in some very kind of specific forms. I think we're going to talk about that a little bit later, not just really the messages, but also the kind of media. Because so far we've been talking about basically short stories going into novels, but also we should be talking about VR, video mm-hmm. games, comic books, the movies, those things, which do reach that mainstream audience, mm-hmm. and how best to make that message fit so that we're not just in our own way being reactionary, but actually pushing for change in the narrative.
Okay. Yeah, something that happened on Fox, not Fox News, but Fox is more... I guess palatable brand is on the television show Lucifer. There was a moment where you wouldn't necessarily notice it. I've been a video editor for years, so I caught this, where I'm fairly sure in post-production this was added, where the character of Lucifer is answering questions that his therapist is asking about evil people in hell. I assume I can say hell when I'm describing the place in Christian mythology on air. And
well, you watch your effing language.
and the therapist is asking questions. Well, what about Hitler? What about Mussolini? And Lucifer waves off the question, says, "Look, we could be here all day talking about evil people and list them." And there's a cutaway to her reaction shot when he says, "And Trump," and then hastens that, "Oh, he's not dead, but you know he's going there." Which I think is actually, when you stop and think about it, one, it clearly was added in post-production, or if it wasn't, it's an odd coincidence that the camera wasn't on his face when he said it. Mm-hmm. But I also think what's kind of hilarious and ironic about that moment is that the writers were like, okay, we want to take a swipe at Trump, but we also want to make sure that there's no way this could be interpreted as a threat on the president's life. So rather than risk portraying him as being dead, as in, well, Trump's dead in this universe and that's a death threat, they clarified that point. And I say ironic because I think that the writers of the show Lucifer, in that rewrite that happened in post-production a week before, put more thought and care into the words they were writing than I think Trump ever has in anything he has said on the campaign trail.
Yeah.
In terms of implications and how to say the right thing to get the result you want.
Well, he has no filter.
No.
He has no filter of any kind. The one thing that I would say is that there is hope, because there is for the media, because there is such a thing as alternative media. As long as WBAI is here, and let me tell you something, folks, we are hanging by such a thin thread. We have met the enemy, and it is us. The infighting on the radical left can be very severe. And, we don't own ourselves. We're owned by a foundation in California of those stations that I mentioned earlier. And they're underfunded. And as this kind of thing happens, there is fighting to be had. But we are still here. Listen. When Lou Hill created Pacifica, he invented the concept of listener-sponsored radio. We are not funded by grants. We are funded by you, the listeners, which is why when we interminably go on the air and beg for money, it's meaningful. And we have said in the past, and we're going to say it in the future now more than ever, but outside of Pacifica Radio, outside of cable TV and BRIC, the Brooklyn Public Access Arts Organization, which is run by a former station manager of BAI, Anthony Riddle, who's doing a wonderful job there so far as I can see, and I can see some of it. As long as there are independent web publications owned by individuals, such as Clark's World, such as Strange Horizons, as
Boing Boing.
Boing Boing, although they don't publish fiction.
Kaleidocast.
Kaleidocast, which is a publisher of, but usually now, are you doing any original stories?
Yes.
Oh, you are. Well, not just
more original than reprint, though we do reprints.
Okay, very good. So Kaleidocast then absolutely qualifies, and the fiction podcasts are a bold new form. in which people are very free to express and people are very free to subscribe to or not. Their only problem is getting the word out that we exist.
I mean, I think some of that, again, has to go to, you know, being more compatibility between different forms of media. So, like, most of my friends, like 99% of my friends are geeks, nerds. They go to Comic-Con. What they read are comics and novels. The majority of them don't read short fiction. So the messages that we would want them to see, we want them to read, would have to be in some form that they will take it either as a direct message or they'll take it as part of the story. But that has to, that, I mean, we have people who are writing amazing stories, and like you said, in Clark's world, but unless they have access to other forms, they're just not going to be seen. Like Arrival, that's a short story. We had to wait how many years for that story to make it to the big screen? Now, it's coming at the...
Well, that's almost always the case, and there's a lot of great classic era science fiction that is so relevant that still hasn't made it to the screen. How about Slan by A.E. Van Vogt from the 40s? You know, to give an example of hatred of the other. And all of that stuff going on, it's perhaps today a little bit dated. But I was just going to say, short stories are my favorite form, and a fine form, but there's a lot in novels. Le Guin's strongest writings are in her novels, Left Hand of Darkness, The Dispossessed, and the things in which she's making her statements. Butler was able to get in both, but more people read her novels than read her stories. So all I'm arguing about is the length.
The length of
the work, of the writing.
But I think also in addition to the length, there's also the factor that short stories, and perhaps especially audio short stories or podcasted short stories, is a much more nimble way to get stories out. That I think that I could have a manuscript good to go on a novel and have an agent, and I still will not see the physical artifact of that book for 4 or 5 or 7 years. Whereas, I mean, anyone who's had their short story held at Analog for 18 months, I guess it doesn't apply. But, you know, we brought up...
And one of the best is Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, which has a lead time of 3 years.
But you know, then you got your Neil Clarks who get back to you just so quickly.
Neil and John Joseph Adams will accept or reject something before you submit.
24 hours.
Generally. FNSF as well.
Julia Rios, who used to be at Strange Horizons and is now at Uncanny, has a great turnaround as well.
She moved to Uncanny.
She did. She's
a cool person.
Oh, and just in case anybody is looking... What? I didn't touch anything.
Tap-tap-a-roo.
So in case anyone is looking to get something off their chest right now, I think Uncanny just asked for your angriest story right now.
Whoa. Ooh, I have an angry sci-fi.
And Julia Rios is the right person to ask for that, isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that makes sense.
I hope I got that
right. When I tell you it's angry, it's so angry.
Okay.
But specifically because of...
Yeah.
Well, but this is what I've been saying, is that this, what's going on is a horrible, horrible, horrible thing that hopefully will make any true thinking human's blood stir. And so I brought in 4 such people to represent some of the people who are feeling the pain and whose art, no doubt, is being driven by this turn of events. So I am trying to make, you know, better lemonade out of bad sour lemons. No, that doesn't work, but you know what I'm trying to say. if I were really verbose, I'd have a better time slot. No, but the...
when life gives you lemons, freeze them and then throw them at people so that...
That works. I like that. But the point is, not only that there will be a reaction to this that will help the arts flourish, but today we have an advantage that they did not have then. We have more alternative publications.
Absolutely.
There wasn't an Uncanny or a Strange Horizons or a Lightspeed or a Clark's World in the 40s. those outlets did not exist. You could not self-publish anything that wasn't a vanity press that was really horrible. You could not record something and put it on YouTube or on a podcast stream or anything like that. People now have a limited access to media. Not necessarily, some people have access to places like WBAI. Other people have access to podcasts and things like that.
And then it becomes sort of a question of sorting through it, because it's just so much. Like, no one person could ever consume all of it. I mean,
which is why you then need the gateway sites, the places that will review and point at, this was really good. This is not, there was a really good one, which became, unfortunately, a rabbit puppy that was specifically for short stories, he said, tangentially speaking. But
I was going to say, I mean, social media gets a bad rap for so many things, but I think one of the utilities of social media is that if there is a story that Terry likes and posts a link to, I'm going to see it quickly. And if there's a story I like that Cam wants to read, that he can find it through my site. That social curation of fiction, I think, to Mallory's point, can be a way to.
It's a good term.
I mean, certainly a lot will get lost in the wash, but that's true no matter what. And I think that to a certain extent, reading important fiction and then passing it on to people who's.
And I think that's sort of where sites like Tumblr and Twitter come in, is that you follow people less for what they have to say and more for their tastes. You follow people because they share things that you like.
And Sturgeon's law still applies, though.
What was that?
Sturgeon's law. Sturgeon's law, as in Theodore Sturgeon, is 95% of science fiction is pure crud. And the corollary to Sturgeon's law is 95% of everything is pure crud. But the point is separating the wheat from the chaff, to make a metaphor.
But I think that also gives us a chance as far as Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers Group, just a little plug right there, for us to become a bit of a bastion, to be honest, because with how we arrived at ReaderCon and how we not only are just a writing group, there is a genuine kinship in getting us better, in getting every single one of us better as better writers, getting us published, getting us out there. And we represent so many marginalized pieces that within the strength of us, our numbers and our presence, hopefully that also gives us credence as far as what we do end up recommending. Because, when I retweeted Brooke Bolander's recent story, Our Talents Crush Galaxies, which is an incredible answer to the mess that was Swimming Boy, because I don't even want to say his name, but something as angry and as short and as unbelievably to the point and so beautifully done, like, that was an amazing amount of retweets. And because of those retweets, I ended up getting a little bit more attention from other people that are into sci-fi and fantasy and speculative fiction. So from there, I also retweeted Kesey, and I'm probably going to say his name wrong because I'm a reader and I'm not a listener. No, I'm kidding. But Kesey Lyman had an amazing short story. So just basically becoming, just like Mallory mentioned, having an audience based on your taste and not, some kind of ridiculous quote or something at some point or another, having that following based on taste, having that following based on your own work and what you are promoting for your own work is definitely something that will end up broadening not just your own horizons, because people tweet at me different short stories, but also will end up broadening the horizons of your followers and bringing in more followers.
So we haven't really talked about what BSFW does, have we?
Yeah, I was actually going to mention that.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a distinction that I've had a lot of people on the air frequently who are from different writers' groups, like Altered Fluid, which has helped produce such people. N.K. Jemisin Nora would be Nora no matter what.
Oh, my God, but fangirl squee.
But she was here just a month ago.
Oh, my God.
Nora's been on the show over a dozen times.
I know. The thing is that I joke with Nora all the time. Every time I see her, I would do like a whole fangirl dance.
Oh, God, she's like, please because stop. Because she is please that person. Yeah,
right,
she's
amazing.
Sorry, can you do it?
The fangirl dance?
Yeah.
I hope you're all looking at your radios now.
Yeah, look at your radios. My hands are flailing.
I could put you on Periscope, but I'll be nice.
No, don't do that. It's 2 a.m. Come on.
Yeah, really. No,
in case you're wondering, you know Kermit's flailing arms when he does the
That's pretty much
but my point is there are different writers groups. There's the Tabula Rasa writers group. There is the Circle in the Hair writers group, which has some very, very fine people in it, but they're not very out in the world, so they don't know, so I won't name who's in that group. And that's like six people, Circle in the Hair. And the other one, which includes Tabula Rasa, which has Rick Bowes and Terrence Taylor and Barbara Krasnoff and a few other people, and Rick is also in Altered Fluid. Altered Fluid has about a dozen or so people. What these groups do is they read each other's works and they do crits. Longtime listeners to the show know that we did about 7 or 8 episodes of having every member of Altered Fluid in here, one of whom would read a story and then suffer while the other 11 people would do their crits. Such and such. I thought that was a great story, except for that part where, and so forth. And we're going to, by the way, try to do that yet again. It's been too long since we had Altered Fluid, the whole group live. They can't be in this room, but we got a nice space downstairs, which we're going to try to involve BSFW in as well. But the BSFW is more than just a place in which people write and do critiques. It is my impression, and I'm not a member, so please correct me if I am wrong, that you're a bit more activist.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no two bleeping ways about it. Cam's like leading towards the mic, like, well, no.
And Terry comes in.
I
told Terry before we walked in here that she is going to be my black anger translator.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm hopping around the room right now. You know what I'm saying? Got my rings on. No, I'm kidding.
You do voices.
I do voices.
You do voices.
Give the Vaseline and pepper.
To be clear, we do have the crit component that we do meet multiple times a month at different people's houses to review novel sections and short stories. But yeah, a lot of what BSFW is exists outside that context.
It's also
well.
Much larger. Than the other groups.
Yeah.
Altered Fluid is, you know, at its highest, about 15 or 16 people. Yeah. Approximately how many active people do you have?
We have active, I would say, just over 200 people in the group.
Yeah, so it's a little larger.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, the thing is, when we talk about Brooklyn speculative fiction writers, we talk...
Some are from Queens, for God's sake.
Shh!
There's that one that's from Jersey City. I don't know what she's doing.
I don't know what
she's
doing here.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh. Who does that?
Purge.
Back across the river.
Jersey? Really? Jersey?
Yeah. It's the sixth borough, damn it.
No.
Shut up.
No, but I mean,
I used to work at Liberty Science Center. I know all about it.
Terry already touched upon it, but part of the thing that we always try to do is kind of take those 200 plus people and point them. It's not me, it's the table. The table's jumping by itself. Leave me alone.
Joint is jumping.
Yes.
It's
try to point it towards a particular target, a particular goal, a particular author who has gotten published from our group, and shout to the rafters about it because these are amazing stories, and we are trying to say
no pun intended.
Pun intended. And trying to
amazing stories, really.
Yeah.
Okay.
And trying to do different things, and trying to do exactly what you know this conversation is about. I think one thing that we haven't really talked about so far is the kind of stories and the themes that should be coming out of, I guess, this moment right now, right? So, you know, immediately, like I said before, what's coming out is rage.
Mm-hmm.
Focused rage. Mm-hmm. Put into a story, whatever the narrative form, and saying, get the, this is my country.
But so we're saying that in short stories, obviously, but I think rage is a hard thing to maintain. Do you think we'll be seeing it in novels?
No, I'm talking about short stories. I mean, this has just happened, right? Mm-hmm. So it's coming out in short stories right now.
And sometimes it takes a little time. I think that the... I believe that the best post 9/11 genre story is There's a Hole in the City by the aforementioned Richard Bowes. Mm-hmm. Ellen Datlow thinks it's a particular story, the name of which I forget, is by Lucius Shepard. Not that she doesn't love Rick Bowes. But both of those stories were written several years after the event. It was too raw. It took time to let the wound close over a little bit.
This is a different kind of wound. I think to a certain extent, because of the pre-Trump reactions that were going on, mm-hmm. we already have a number of stories that are coming. We already have, with the table, not me, we already have a number of stories and novels that are coming out, and novellas that are coming out, mm-hmm. which are already kind of, they're already making waves.
For people watching the radios, the table was rising to hit Rob.
About to bite my hands off.
I think a lot of us were hoping that Trump would disappear and that news and that media would be able to move on, and we would never have to think of him ever again.
There was a really interesting interview with a major actor and writer, I don't recall who, on a British mm-hmm. show. Was saying that he was just fascinated by Trump because it was Bryan Cranston. He said it was the pure demagogue in its rawest form, rising, doing all of this stuff and towering over it all. But when you get down to it, all that he had to say was, there are problems, everything's awful. We will fix it. I will fix it. There are problems, everything's awful. I will fix it. That was his entire platform.
And it's their fault. Those people over there.
Yes. Yes. And then what Cranston said, which is what set me off in saying this, is he said, and I really hope that November 9th is the last time we will hear his name.
You know, even if he lost, we would still be having the same conversation.
That is exactly the problem.
But it would be a very different conversation.
Yeah, that would be an if this goes on conversation rather than...
What it would be is it wouldn't be as... You wouldn't have a symbol, a direct symbol, right, mm-hmm. to be pointing at and saying, this is what has been going wrong. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny. I have with me this set of short stories called Octavia's Brood, science fiction stories from social justice movement. This is 2015.
Edited by and published by?
Edited by, I want to make sure I say their names correctly, Adrienne Marie Brown and Walida Imarisha.
Yes.
Okay. This was 2015.
And published by?
And published by...
Small presses we have to...
Is that Rosario?
Yeah.
AK Press?
Oh,
AK. Okay.
Sorry. AK Press.
Yeah.
I feel like that, was that Kickstartered?
I think it was.
I remember when that was.
I think it was crowdfunded.
You know, there's a.
And that's just what I was saying earlier.
Yeah. There's a dimension to this that I think just to allow you, you're absolutely right that even if Donald Trump had not won the election, there was a conversation to be had about the fact that he would have come as close to winning as he did.
The fact that he was nominated.
Right, but the fact that he was elected adds a dimension to this that I think it's going to be mm-hmm. important moving forward is that I was reminded a little bit of Juno Diaz in The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao discussing the relationship between writers in the Dominican Republic and Trujillo and saying that there is this ancient and irreversible enmity between scribblers and tyrants that artists and writers cannot help but respond to the systemic injustice, and perhaps more importantly, that political tyrants can't stand to hear it. And that I think that what we certainly have seen from Trump at this point is a utter willingness to proactively try and suppress journalists who he doesn't like, who he doesn't like what they're saying. And I think that
I thought that the reason he was running mm-hmm. at all was so that he could create his empire to outdo Murdoch, mm-hmm. which is why he went so much against Fox News.
Maybe that was why he was originally running, now he's president.
Yeah. But
I didn't think he thought he would be.
kind of.
But, no, absolutely not. But you can tell. He has no idea what to do with his hands. Yeah. Like, he doesn't... Every time that he's on screen now, he's absolutely shell-shocked. And he did not think he was going to go this far.
He was clueless, and he remains.
And he remains clueless. And the funny thing is, Cam brought up Octavia's Brood and the fact that it was published in 2015, meaning that these stories were gathered between, 2012 to 2014... the short story that I got really excited to possibly turn into Uncanny as far as the Rage, I started that, I would say, probably in 2014. Mm-hmm. And I remember distinctly, because I actually have a writing partner that I send a lot of work in progress to,
Somebody you collaborate with or somebody you share with?
I share with, pretty much. And I remember distinctly starting this story because I think I actually, it wasn't Sandra Bland. There was something else that happened that occurred that was extremely racially motivated, not just racially, but it was misogynoir, as the term is now there, where it was...
There's been no lack of it in the last 2 years.
Exactly. And it made me so angry. That I started the story and it ended up morphing into the white man ego, which ended up compromising everyone else.
I don't know why you're sorry to say that, but why did that become speculative fiction?
The specific story that I'm
thinking of? Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is Jim now talking to SF Writer.
It became speculative because I think...
Because part of what I want to prove to the powers that be here and the listeners at home are that speculative fiction is the place to turn to for provocative...
Exactly.
...thinking. Mm-hmm. And the first place that sometimes people look to not just, rant against the wind, but not necessarily to find immediate solutions, but ways to think.
Present those issues in a way that ends up... Because I actually had this conversation with someone the other night, is that I've always been attracted to horror and speculative fiction. I've always been attracted to horror movies. I mean, it could be from the slasher movies to actually actual examinations. Like,
I'm a wuss.
Well, I mean, there's also some really good...
I like horror movies. I don't like splatter films.
Well, yeah, you have the gore porn and you have the splatter films.
But so... I have a word I've been trying to coin, gornography.
That's a good one. I like that. But even within gornography, because you have Texas Chainsaw, which to me is a fantastic horror film. But anyway... veering. But speculative fiction is the genre in which is the area, because I don't even want to call it a genre, but the area in which that really examines and really presents a lot of issues in such a raw way that you will not find, to me, in literary fiction. There's an examination that is so much deeper by using these supposed fantastical elements that we're all a little bit curious about. I mean, we're all a little fascinated by death. We're all a little fascinated by time and by movement. These fantastical elements are placed within the reach of this genre and splayed out in front of you. And it truly gives vehicle to actually examining human condition in every single bit and piece that you can think of, to me. It's something that's not explored within literary in the sense that would make you think that is done within speculative fiction.
Unless, of course, they are taking spec fic and they are putting it into their literary.
I don't see, by the way, why literary fic and spec fic, when you're dealing with names like Juno Diaz and Octavia Butler and so forth, how are they distinct from each other?
Exactly.
But, where we sell them in the bookstore, basically. Yeah.
And Ted Chiang.
Well, that's it. It's marketing. It's marketing.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then Ted Chiang. I mean, you have Ted Chiang, who's not a prolific writer, but every single one of his stories are incredible examinations of the human capacity. And the thing is that it's all using speculative fiction elements. To me, it's literary speculative fiction.
Well, and this, I think, goes back to the point of I think, at least for me, you know, how do you reach those people who, quite frankly, I think need to be reached?
Oh, my God,
because,
yes.
Because, you know, like I said before, majority of my friends, they do read speculative fiction, and I've gotten into arguments with them where I talk about me as a writer saying this is the reason why I write. They say, no, that's not the reason why I read. I'm not reading because I want to get this huge message. I'm reading because I need an escape. So while at the same time we are able to get these messages, there's also a bit of subversiveness that needs.
Absolutely.
And some things are more subversive than others. I just wonder how, I guess we should be gauging how subversive can we be to get into that mainstream, make that switch.
Okay, so I am from Texas, which is not usually the first thing that I want people to know about me. But as a young geek growing up in Texas...
Hey, Michael Moorcock lives in Texas.
A lot of people, nice people do.
sorry, go on. Austin is
it's
a nice
really
town.
Big.
Okay,
oh,
sorry,
Austin,
go on,
yeah,
Mallory.
The one
go on, Mallory.
Little
yeah.
Tiny Pinbrook. It's a big state. So I grew up in a small-ish conservative town. Young nerd, who's friends with young nerds, and a lot of them were low-income. A lot of them didn't have, like... a way out. They were going to go to the community college at best, and they were going to be managers at IHOP. And I was like one of the few friends in my like graduating class that went to college at a university. All of them were huge nerds. All of them read science fiction, fantasy to escape. And I think they were all better people for it. I think that like showed them a world. I know it showed me a world. Outside of the really small picture that I had. It showed me that there was stuff that if I left my like small little planet, I would find something else out there.
The small little planet being her town, y'all.
Yeah.
Allegory.
Thank you for recognizing that.
I think what you can kind of almost reverse engineer from that is that... I mean, people may say they want to read for escapism and that they're nominally uninterested in didactic ideology. But at the same time, is that people who live in the world, even if they don't know they know what's wrong with the world, will sometimes realize they do know that in the escape, the emotional engagement, the thing that brings them in, that gives them the, you know, rush of endorphins when something interesting or unexpected or powerful happens in a story speaks to their truth, and it may not be a truth that they knew that they knew.
And therefore the subversiveness.
Right. And Texas is a red state. It's becoming a swing state, but most of the people I knew from high school, from before that, they're Republicans, despite what they read, or, you know. And I do think that that is sort of, I do think that that is sort of like the only way that, like, we can reach them is through media.
Okay, so you're not going to believe this, but we have 3 minutes left.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, right? I told you would go fast, didn't I? Now, this is not the last time we're going to be doing this. This
absolutely
is too
not.
Too important.
Yes.
The conversation is too good. I want it to be also more interactive with telephone calls and perhaps a live town hall forum that we're discussing, where we can all get together and do something. Not necessarily even for the air. One of it could just be, you know, let's everybody meet and talk and something like that. But also, I'd like to get the radio station involved. The events that I do here at 388 are not actually part of the radio station at all, other than I record them, sometimes broadcast them. But what I want to do for now is, A, I want to go person by person, what you have in print, how people can reach your website. One of you will be the designated BSFW promoter and tell us more about that organization. And also, as you do that, we'll go clockwise from Mallory, Terry, Sam, and Rob. And also, I want you to say what you think people should be doing vis-a-vis the arts now. Should they be reading, writing, singing?
Okay. So I don't have anything in print, but you can follow me on Twitter at Lady of the Hag. My last name's Hagman. I had to go with it.
Two N's, not like Larry Hagman, two N's on the end.
Yeah, yeah. I got that a lot. We actually grew up in the same town in Ooh. Texas. I know.
you know, his mother was.
Yeah, yeah. We have a statue of her in front of our library.
What?
Oh, cool. I know. It was my childhood library. Okay, but there was a point that I needed to make.
Sorry.
what arts?
All right, right, so what we need to be doing in the arts right now.
Off here.
It's a lot. I think we need to be talking to
each
other.
Okay, people can find you on Twitter. Oh, yeah,
yeah,
sorry.
I think we need to be talking to each other. I know this isn't really in the arts, but I think we need to, like... So my mother, if she voted for Clinton, but I think if the political divide wasn't so extreme right now, she'd probably be a moderate Republican. And after the election, I decided to have the talk with her. Politics talk. I think that's kind of.
We only have 3 minutes, Mallory.
I know. Okay. I think that's
important. No, not even that now.
I think that's important, is that we need to, like, talk to our families.
And friends.
And friends.
Loved ones.
As Jim introduced me, I am Terry Clark. My professional known name is Zin E. Rocklin.
But Terry is spelled T-E-R-I.
Yes, one R and an I, thank you. And there's an E at the end of Clark, because I'm very British and I'm, you know, very...
Like Sir Arthur.
...sophisticated. I don't appreciate you laughing at me.
Susanna Clark.
That was a snort, not a laugh. Keep going, though.
Anyway, so you can find me... It was a guffaw. You can find me on Twitter at Intelligent Watt. It's kind of read as Intelligent Watt. sorry. And I have two horror stories that are coming out in two separate anthologies next year. Actually, one is slated to hopefully come out the end of December this year, and the other is February 2017. The first one is Colors in Darkness, Forever Vacancy, basically surrounded around a motel with a creepy innkeeper. And, then the one in February is called Sycorax's Daughters, which is a collective of all black female horror writers. And that's going to be exciting.
And who's editing that?
The editors are Linda D. Addison.
Oh, her.
Yeah. Right? No big deal. No big deal. Yeah. Kenicha Jallo, and I am so sorry I'm forgetting the last name.
I don't know the second woman. Linda, of course, is an old
Yeah,
pal.
Kenicha Jallo is amazing. She's a professor at University of Texas. She actually just got a little bit of shine on her because she is teaching her course on Beyonce's Lemonade, and it is tearing. It is beautiful. It's so well done. I'm not even a Beyonce fan.
Okay, so when that comes out, we're gonna have another show with that. Yeah, and sure, with Linda.
And with Linda. Yes, Linda, come on. Linda, listen.
Linda hasn't been on this show in like a year.
Well, Linda needs to get it together. Yeah. As far as what we need to do in the arts, any and everything. Express our voices, write, if it's singing, do it. If it's guitar, do it, anything.
And partake.
And I do agree with Mallory as well. We need to have hard conversations. Without having conversations, we will not get anywhere.
Sam Schreiber.
Yes, I publish under Sam Schreiber.
Spelled.
That's also my name.
S-A-M. No, sorry.
S-C-H-R-E-I-B as in boy, E-R, like Leave Schreiber, no relation.
Oh my God, I love it.
No relation to Pablo Schreiber either. I've got work you can read in Analog Science Fiction and Fact, and a lot of different podcasts, Podcastle, the Dunes Thief Audio Fiction Magazine, Journey Into. And as for what we can do, it's I think that it is going to become increasingly important to not try and let the round hole and the square peg stop making friction, that the white supremacy of this cultural movement that we are now in the thick of is incompatible with who we've become as artists and just as people in this country. We have to make sure those sparks don't stop flying, that we can't let that schism become less obvious and apparent and make people aware of it than we have.
Outstanding. And my name is Rob Cameron. My website is rob-cameron.com, unorthodox box. You can find me on Twitter at CPRWords. Our website for Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers is bsfwriters.com. You also can find this our podcast kaleidocast.nyc.com.
When does the second season of that begin?
It's probably going to be around May of next year. That's what we're aiming for.
Another show.
Yeah. As far as what artists. Writers specifically, I think, can and should do is be very precise about the stories that we're telling, subvert everything, try to get into their mind space as quickly and as efficiently as possible, and again have those conversations to do it not just so you're not going just by yourself, you're doing it with the army behind you, 200 plus.
Damn right.
BSFW, what's up? And as for everybody else, I will agree, having those difficult conversations with people that you like and that you don't like, yet somehow you can still debate and not shout at each other.
And listen. We have to listen to listen.
I don't listen to nothing.
And keep listening to WBAI, by the way, because we do have a voice out there. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff out there, including, National Public Radio, which, remember, is a government agency, so they will have problems being funded. And same for PBS, but Pacifica Radio is funded by you. So when we keep begging for money, I know it's horrible. I know it's incessant. Be there. Be listening. Be a part of it. I hope that we're going to get new voices on the air and that this is a method that we are beginning to try to make that process happen here at WBAI. It's been way too long for that to happen. But having said that, I've only been here for 49 years, so be sure to tune in next week at 1:30 a.m. Wednesday morning for the next Hour of the Wolf. Oh, that's Thanksgiving morning, so I'm going to probably pre-record that. So I will have a guest for you because I've got all this stuff. It might be Nisi Shaw, who I just recorded on.
Nisi? I
can't. She left. Was here on Monday. I recorded her on Monday, but I couldn't tell her that because I spent too much time gushing at her. Oh my, she was wonderful. Oh my God, she was so wonderful. I can't begin to tell you how. Thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister, who's going to keep his clothes on for at least 30 seconds. At any rate, maybe I lie. We'll see about that. Okay, there we go. There we go. That did it. All of you at home, avert, avert, avert. Thank you for listening. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We'll be doing this again. And we're going to bring a thick pad of styrofoam just for Rob. Just okay. Take care. Be good to each other, folk, because you deserve it and we deserve it. And I will be playing some of Sonia Tafe's poems next week.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary, and you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am a bitch.
The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth put on hold. The
have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk. Cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this writing. The Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm messy attack. The flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
a bitch. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth put on hold. The bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag. Like many others take the same turn like me, they yearn for the flag too.
Fascists on the attack, we will counter attack. cheetah. And some of them say them a black scabber. And some of them say them a Paki Basha. Fascists on the top, no bother worry about that. Fascists on the top, we will fight them back. Fascists on the top, then we will counter attack. Fascists on the top, then we drive them back. Gonna smash their brains in.
Yeah, 99 Cinco List Alive, Burn Baby Burn, where we burn the imperialist red, white and blue in the heart of white supremacist country, imperialist USA. Burn that old glory to ashes before 5 o'clock. Yes. Fascists on the attack, we gotta fight them back no matter where they pop their heads up. Yeah.